Welcome to the Apria podcast, investing in Asian real assets. The theme of the series is Resurgence of REITs in the Asia Pacific, featuring REITs CEOs highlighting market opportunities, strategies, and their professional journey. This series is proudly brought to you by Link Asset Management Limited. In this episode, journalist Mark Cooper speaks with George Hong Choi, the CEO of Link REIT. George rose through the ranks from a professional banker to become the CEO of one of the world's largest retail REITs in terms of market capitalization. George shares his insights on the Asian REIT market and how he has been able to take the business from strength to strength even during these challenging times. George also reveals his commitment to education and his philosophy on corporate social responsibility. Listed in 2005 as the first REIT in Hong Kong, Link has been 100% held by public and institutional investors and is a Hang Seng Index constituent stock. From its home in Hong Kong, Link manages a diversified portfolio including retail facilities, car parks and offices spanning Hong Kong, Beijing, Guangzhou, Shanghai, Shenzhen, London and Sydney.
Welcome to the Apria podcast interview with me, Mark Cooper. Today, I'm very pleased to have a special guest with us. George Hong Choi is Chief Executive of Link Management, which is the management company for the Link REIT, Asia's largest real estate investment trust, which I'm sure you've all heard of. And so it's great to have him with us. Welcome, George.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Yeah, great to be here.
So we generally start with these things with a little bit about yourself and your career. Maybe tell us a little bit about your move to real estate. You were in banking before joining Link REIT. So tell us how you got into the sector.
Well, I was covering Hong Kong clients. And as most of you know, most of the Hong Kong conglomerates have a real estate arm. So I guess that's my first exposure to it. But I really was invited to become the CFO of Link in 2009. And so the entry point was really something that I'm familiar with, from banking and finance into a CFO role, which I did for about a year and a half when the board asked me to become the CEO. In the meantime, I guess the CFO role provided me a very quick exposure to many aspects of real estate and also real estate investment trust.
And I guess with the CFO role, you had your sort of fingers in every bit of the REIT. So you got to kind of get a very quick introduction to everything about real estate and everything about the company.
Yes, you're right. And I had the practice then that I won't approve any CapEx unless I have been to the site to have a look at it. And so that gave me a more detailed exposure than sitting in the office signing checks. So I think that's one thing that got me interested in the operational aspect of the business rather than just the financing.
Okay, great. Tell us a bit about your working week and its patterns. I know everyone always says they don't have a typical week, but maybe kind of run us through a standard sort of week or what you might be doing this week or next, for example.
I think the broad headline for my typical week is not too different. The contents might be different, but a few sort of big headlines. I spend a lot of time dealing with people's issues, hiring, motivating, promoting, and all that. I think people, it's sometimes even more important than the real estate. Someone need to manage it and to extract values out of it. The second part is about strategy, and so we're discussing with our colleagues, our people in the industry to understand big trends and how we should adapt to changing environment. Thirdly is relationship, whether it's with board members, so that they have a good pulse of what's going on with our business, with various stakeholders. So this is one example. Interviews, meetings to share publicly our initiatives, our strategies, our challenges. And the fourth is the what you would expect in terms of more detailed operations. So spent a fair bit of time with our leasing team, our asset management team, to make sure that we can deal with the challenges. But also, I look at it more strategically as well, rather than how much rental adjustment for a particular lease, but more of thinking about strategy with regard to certain trade or certain large tenant group, and how are they going to change and how shall we support them. I spend also a fair bit of time with our project team in terms of design. While I was trained as an accountant and a banker, I actually quite enjoy the design aspect. So my team knows that I'm the one to choose the color for any changes to the properties. So those aspects give me, I guess, all packed together an interesting week.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to go on the strategy aspect of it, how widely do you sort of spread your net in kind of bringing in ideas for strategy? Do you talk with senior management, with wider staff, and how much involvement do you give to sort of external knowledge sources?
Depending on which aspect of the strategy, I think there are several layers to it, and I think what we have done over the last 10 years is that when we look at a real estate investment trust, we put as much emphasis on the real estate as we would put on the word investment. So in terms of what we should do with real estate long term, in terms of sustainability, green, etc., we have done quite a lot. And people obviously now talk a lot about environmental issues, etc. We announced recently a net zero carbon target by 2035. But over the last 10 years, for example, we've already saved 40% of our energy usage compared to 2010. So there's a lot of detail to that, a lot of, I guess for me, is discussing priorities and timing. What do we do first or rather than later? So from installing building management system to changing chillers, and more recently, installing solar panels to rooftops in order to generate electricity. And so that part of the strategy in terms of asset management, something that I guess internally, but also with a lot of specialists in particular fields that requires, I guess, most up-to-date input. The other part of running a REIT is portfolio management. And we do a lot of discussion and modeling in order to come up with a portfolio that is resilient with the volatility in the market, is diversified, and resulting in the ability that we have been delivering, growing distribution every year to our investors. So that one part is something that I spend a fair bit of time on, and we spending a lot of time also learning from key players, leading players around the world, to see what are some of the things that they have done right, what are some of the things that we can learn from. And then lastly, the third aspect is capital management. If we continue to manage ourselves well, we have a very good credit rating, which allow us to be very competitive, given the lower cost of funding, to bid for assets. And we have been saving on interest expense as we structure our capital in terms of liability management. And so all three involve, I guess, the different parties, different level of details. And then when you put it all together, sort of a general sort of big picture direction, where do we go? Where should we be 5 years from now, 10 years from now? That's we have an annual strategy discussion with our board, so that can revisit, fine tune the direction. And in 2019, we came up with the what we now call Vision 2025, that we think we should focus our energy on several key aspects to deliver on some of the targets that we set for Vision 2025, which is going to be measured at the end of the financial year 25-26. So it is a very broad range of topics that we cover, all towards really just, you know, how can we deliver a sustainable growing return to our investors.
Okay, yeah, that sounds like a busy week, a busy life generally. Do you still, so you mentioned that when you were CFO, you would visit assets to see if they deserved or needed CapEx. Do you still have plenty of time to visit the REIT's assets? I mean, even the existing ones, as well as those that are new or being worked on. And I wonder, do you feel an attachment to the buildings themselves? I mean, a lot of people in real estate really like the kind of the assets and the hard part of it as well. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I do visit the assets quite a bit. You know, we do have a lot, and we have some outside of Hong Kong. And so to do a one round, really not possible within a short time. But those that are particularly, I guess, need particular attention, for example, we are changing either design or changing the tray mix, then I'll definitely be there before and after those changes I make to understand the impact. I cook at home, so I do go to our fresh markets and love going there to buy the fresh produce that we have in our fresh market. So I do go to the markets quite frequently, trying to go to different ones to see how they are managed. We don't have a particular attachment to any assets. I think you know, we learn over the years at the end, you know, that there are, you know, each property have its cycle, and also from a portfolio management point of view, whether the asset fit into the growth trajectory that we want to build for the REIT. Some assets, regardless of whether their size, regardless of how big or small they are, it's really about whether the growth prospects align with what we want to have going forward. So it's from that point of view, we if they are good for the next 3 years, they we will own them, or 10 years. You know, we do look at each of the assets as a long-term investment, but you know, if someone gives us the right price, we wouldn't mind doing a capital recycling into even better assets. So no particular attachment. Maybe, you know, I came from the banking world. I looked at sort of cash flow, you know, cash inflow and outflow, and real estate at the end of the day has to be translated into cash flow. I suppose if we have developed it, spent a lot of energy in it, but you know, we've done a lot of asset enhancement. We don't have any particular reason to be attached to any assets. I think even if we have a brand put on it, and when we have branded a lot of our assets, especially in China, if we do sell it, I mean, just as when we bought assets from others, after a transition period, you know, the name can be taken off. So it's really about what we can deliver to our investors rather than attachment.
Yeah, you can't afford to be sentimental, I guess. I wanted to move to something else. I've been, you can tell from this, I've been looking at your CV on LinkedIn. I saw that you're now an adjunct professor at HKU. I'd just be interested to know a bit about what that role involves and when and why you got involved in education.
I've always been very keen in education in various aspects. That particular role required me to give lectures to students in the architecture and design departments and so. But my interest in education is much broader than that particular role. I am very active in my with my alma mater, University of Pennsylvania, as a trustee, and donated a lot of scholarship to different universities. And then with Link, we have also the Link Scholar, the Link University Scholar Program in Hong Kong, where we provided the funding to students who are first generation students going, you know, from their family going to universities. And so, yeah, it's quite important that we inspire and nurture the younger generation. There's a lot of challenges for them, and so to the extent that we can support them to thrive as the next generation, I personally and Link are very keen to do.
Great. Okay. So Link's had an excellent record of growth since it was listed, and your management and your leadership, which are obviously two slightly different things, have been involved with that. Can you tell us about some of the leadership traits that you think have helped with Link's success, either things that are related to you personally or to the systems that the management company has in place?
It is probably a long list. I don't see a particular one or two traits and it's not one person, but obviously it is a team. So, but I do need to list it down. I guess one is staying agile to really be. I'm a pragmatist, very practical, looking at what's going on and work out what are the right way of handling it, rather than a permanent optimist. Handling change, being resilient to the challenges, and serve with a high degree of humility, learning from people, learning from our staff, and to set the vision that pull people together. We very quickly after I became CEO, we fine-tune and announce our vision to be a world-class real estate investor and manager, serving and improving the lives of those around us. With those words, inspire the team and trying to see how we can deliver on those. And because I didn't come from real estate, I asked a lot of stupid questions because I don't know about operations. I don't know a lot about E&M and things like that. And so I can ask a lot of questions that people who have been in an industry would say, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And that's exactly why we managed to do something that other people may not have done earlier, is that I just keep challenging the status quo, challenging how the industry been doing the same thing for a long time, and isn't there another better way of doing it, for example? And I tend to leave the team alone to do their things, but at the same time, I'm in the helicopter. I have the ability and visibility to see if there are certain issues that need my attention. Then I will get the helicopter to land and come down and drill down on details, but most of the time I should go back up, and so that I can see the wood from the trees, and that has been helpful. I think being hands-on enough, but at the same time not intrusive, and being there watching everyone behind their back is probably too much. So the system does allow us to do that. We can track a lot of things these days. But then, for me, I guess one of the philosophy is, if I trust you, right, there's a Chinese saying that if I translate literally is, if you use someone, you have to trust that person. And if you do not trust that person, then you shouldn't use them or her. And so right things to do is, as I said, how I spend the week is spend time on finding the right people, putting it in the right place, and then let them get on with it.
Okay, great. Moving on to sort of a bit more direct stuff about the Link REIT business now. I think I'd kind of hoped, I'm sure we'd all hoped, that nobody would have to ask questions about the pandemic now, still, after more than a year. But it's been tough in Hong Kong for asset owners and for their tenants for the past year or so. Can you tell us a little bit about where the pressure points have been in the Link REIT portfolio, but also a little bit about what you're doing to support tenants and customers and the business itself?
Let me do that helicopter view first before diving into to answering your question in detail. Is that sure. This is almost like a wake-up call, there are a few things that is going on anyway that the pandemic really have speed up some of the changes that is necessary anyway. For example, e-commerce, online purchases, how that affect physical retail. And we've been talking about it for several years. And I guess within a year, there's hardly anyone who haven't done some online shopping. And so the penetration is very high. Although, you know, it's a habit, not every shopper really have switched to do it all the time, but, you know, everyone have that experience. And second is about wellness, about buildings, indoor air quality and cleanliness and all that has come out to be an important topic for some time already. And the pandemic really highlighted how important it is in terms of, you know, indoor air quality, cleanliness. And so one of my managers told me that the last year, especially dealing with frequency of cleaning and the standard, it's not something new. I mean, as a property manager, they have done it for many years, but there's a lot more attention on those topics. So I wouldn't say that there are, across the board stress point. The key one is really in leasing. Some of our tenants obviously require, because of the social distancing rules, not to open beyond certain hours or not to even trade at all. So we have given a 600 million tenant support scheme out for specifically targeted support to certain tenants. So we want them to or at least contribute to help them to survive that tough period. The government in Hong Kong have been very helpful with their employment support scheme as well. And so that helps a lot of the retailers to tide over the toughest period. And China obviously bounced back very quickly. And so less of that requirement. We've given rental concessions. We've given waivers to management fees. We have restructured some of the leases. We have given discount to some of the car park users, particularly school bus drivers. If they park the school buses in our car parks, knowing that they wouldn't have much income during the period when schools were closed, we have done a bit more marketing to the extent that we can attract people to come to our shopping center during periods where the social restrictions are not as tight. All in all, really, to see how we can contribute towards the, supporting our tenants during their toughest time. Having said that, we are very lucky. Use Hong Kong as an example. Since January 2020, we have opened over 450 new shops and F&B outlets. So it's a lot. The lockdown in Hong Kong did not restrict fitting out work, and so when there are tenants which suffers during this pandemic, has to leave us, we have been able to get replacement tenants pretty quickly to allow us to keep our occupancy at very high percentages, high 90s, 96, 97%. And so we're very lucky here in Hong Kong, in China as well, very high occupancy rate. We have also not have to suffer any government policies about embargo and not allowing tenants to forcing tenants to leave because they don't pay rent. I think most of the tenants in Hong Kong and China very willingly leave when they cannot afford it. We just sometimes have to allow tenants to leave before the lease expire and find replacement tenants quickly. And so we have been able to operate in this way for the past year or so, and that requires not just our leasing staff to work very hard, property management, our project team, to the extent that we need to prepare the site for the next tenant.
Yeah.
The leasing team, particularly, I think from a risk management point of view, in the past, we, given that our typical lease terms are 3 years long, so we usually structure it so that we have only 1/3 of the leases expiring every year. But in the past 12 months, I think we talked to 100% of our tenants. We couldn't talk to only 1/3 of them because so many of them come to us and trying to get help even before the lease expired. And so the team was working super hard, we have also put in place quite a lot of support programs to make sure that our staff can handle the stress. And there was a period of time where we have to work from home, making sure that we have technology support to allow Zoom calls and all that make sure that that the team feel that they are still together when they can't be physically together.
And just on that last point, will there be any of the things that you've sort of learned to deal with the period of enforced working from home that you think might stay with the business going forward? I mean, will you be more flexible about people being in the office or not? Or is it sort of back to normal?
I think we'll end up leaning a bit more towards flexible working hours. And so for some of our colleagues, if they have to deal with family issues or decided not to come during rush hour, but maybe arrive a little bit earlier or a little bit later, provided I guess we can still have a core period during the day when for meetings, or even for meetings, sometimes just allow some people to come online. Having said all that, we are also owner of office buildings, and so apart from our own experience, we have also talked to others, our office tenants. Most people, I think, tend to think that the social aspects, the water cooler moments where you can talk about new ideas, the collaboration, those probably require people to be in the office. Building relationship and all that need to be physically done. I think I'm proponent that people will still be in the office 3-4 days a week, for some maybe more. I think the other thing that will change is that over the last many years, there is a sort of densification inside the office. People get less and less space. Maybe it pushes us to reverse that. For example, our office was designed and we moved into this new office in 2019. So it already have some elements which I think helpfully cater for the post-COVID world. We have a lot of hub areas where people can gather, but at the same time, we have some private rooms that they can work in, open plan as well. But there's a lot of different areas where collaboration and discussion can happen. So I don't agree with some of the articles, especially middle of last year, which say, that's the end of the office, people won't go back. I think for most job functions, there's merit to be together. How often is a question. How flexible is one that I think is important for employers to accept. But I think the office are still going to be there. It just need to be designed better for the benefit of the employees.
Yes, I agree with you there. And I think with collaboration, as you said, it's those water cooler moments as much as the formally diarise and set out meetings. It's just those bumping into people moments that often spark ideas. So you mentioned that you're an office owner as well as an office occupier. And I suppose that kind of leads us on to the journey that Link REIT has been on since it's floated with a portfolio of housing estates, shopping centres and car parks. And I saw that you bought last year a Canary Wharf office building, which is obviously a substantial change in sector and geography from how you started. So tell us a bit about that journey and the expansion and maybe a bit more about the Vision 2025 program, which you mentioned earlier on.
We started off, as you said, in housing estate, shopping centres and car parks. And we felt that there was a need in the early years to improve those assets. They were not designed properly, they were not managed properly. And so we spent quite a lot of time understanding those assets because we didn't build them and then trying to improve on them. And if I sum up the result, firstly, we want to make sure that people live above it or next to it, will shop there. Wasn't the case at the time of the IPO. And then over time, we enlarged the catchment to make sure that people who are not just immediate residents will also come and shop. And so we can attract more people to come. And as we do so, tenants are attracted to come to operate at our shopping centres because they realise that there's a steady flow of people who live very nearby, and also an increasing number of people who come from further afield. So we then start to look in organic growth in the first almost 10 years. But we also see that the high concentration in a limited asset class in a single geography pose risks to us in the long run, and it may not be able to deal with the sort of volatility that any real estate cycle will bring. So very early on, we plan to start journey of diversification from geography and also asset type to even going beyond buying existing asset, but to also develop our own, to design and develop our own. And so we started that journey really around 2004, 2005, starting to acquire assets in Hong Kong first, and also as part of funding, rather than funding it all by debt, we have also done some capital recycling, disposing some of our assets. So in the way that I have described it to you earlier in what we do, the first part of asset management, making sure the asset really are productive, continues even to today. And then the second part, which is portfolio management, what should we have in our portfolio? And we have bought some assets that have grown the net property income very well, especially those assets in China. At the same time, as we look into a slightly more challenging time, and we sort of started that before the pandemic, but we see that the cycle might demand us to be a bit more cautious. Then we bought office building in Sydney and then in London. What that allow us to do is to fill the void of some of the market downturn that has impacted on our results in Hong Kong and China. Mm-hmm. So it's really from that portfolio management point of view that we see where are the gaps in which year, how can we fill it, and sometimes it's easier to fill assets that easier to say that we fill assets with strong growth, but at the same time, if you want to buy assets with growth, it also comes with some volatility, that there may be years where it will come down because of real estate cycle. So we decided that it would be better to buy asset with which those two have certain elements that I think was attractive for us in a volatile year, that long well asset with tenants with very high credit ratings, certainty of income. And for those two, while not a lot of people went to the office to work both in Sydney and London, but the tenants, you know, it's 100% occupied and they keep paying rent. And so that stability was extremely helpful for us, especially in that part, in the past financial year. We will continue to look at each year to see what sort of gaps from both organic growth and inorganic growth that we should fill. And so part of the Vision 2025, I guess, the part that a lot of people focus on is portfolio growth. And we have a target of achieving a high single-digit CAGR growth in our asset under management, and hopefully that translates to a growing distribution to our investors as well. And then to the two other probably less quoted part of Vision 2025, and one is called Culture of Excellence, which have a lot of focus on how to improve on how we manage the business. So firstly, making sure that we are employer of choice in our field, and also to make sure that we have a continuous review to upgrade our systems. Just this year alone, we are upgrading our ERP, installing facility management IT systems. We are looking at our CRM system for our leasing team. And so making sure that we try to upgrade and be at the forefront of the technological support. And the third element is what we call visionary creativity, which really focus on design, focus on sustainability, and making sure that the assets are at the best quality from the tenant's point of view. So we've done quite a lot in those upgrades. We're trying to, for example, in Hong Kong, get our buildings to be certified green. And so we have BEAM ratings for our properties in Hong Kong, and we continue to get those certification done as we get that rolled out through the portfolio. And so it's across those three key elements that we want to make sure that we can deliver on the bottom line. As we grow the bottom line, as we grow our asset under management, obviously every time you grow a little bit more, the baseline for next year is going to be higher and higher and higher. And so we need to be more and more creative.
And you mentioned some of the things you do to support the strategy, but have you had to make changes to sort of the staffing or maybe the type of people you employ to for the broader strategy, in particular for investing outside of Hong Kong?
Yeah, quite a lot. I think, and this is ongoing because we still just going through this sort of gradual diversification. But we've done a lot both to the systems and to people. And the systems, I mentioned some of them earlier. Whether it's the building management, energy management, facility management, ERP, our business intelligence software. So a lot of it is just to try and improve the efficiency, in improve the control as we have more assets further afield. Then we really have to rely on the alert system from these softwares. From people, we have young talent, management trainee, management associate program for some time. We continue to want to try and develop our own people. And as we grow and have a critical mass, for example, in China, We have now set up a China head office in Shanghai in our building Link Square. We didn't have to do so in the past. I guess when you own only a few assets, you can manage everything from head office. But we have all reorganized ourselves recently so that Hong Kong really perform two functions. There's a group head office function, and then there is a Hong Kong regional center function. And then, you know, in Shanghai, running the China regional center. And so I think, you know, as we expand to places where we have, or countries where we have a critical mass, we will replicate that country function as well, so that the delineation of task and the accountability is a lot clearer. And we also put that in place so that it becomes easier within the organization structure to hire local people to make sure that they can see a career path with us. And so these are gradual changes, significant changes though, in order that we continue to attract the best talent to help us with our strategy.
Uh-huh. And does the investor base been supportive to the evolution in strategy? And has it changed at all as Link has changed?
The investors are generally conservative, and so usually joke with them that you know, it's, if you don't change, then you can't continue to deliver the growing income. You can't deal with the volatility in the market. But when you change, investors like you to change within a second. So you're either A today and you can become B tomorrow. And sometimes it takes a year or 2 years to go from A to B. And there's not a lot of allowances given to that period. They are rather impatient. And so we have to keep communicating to them, sharing with them the progress that we have made, that we are in the right direction, we are in the right momentum, and give us time. And in the meantime, we still have to deliver the goods to make sure that we can deliver the growing bottom line. And so it's not easy. We have many different groups of investors, you know, from real estate funds to income funds, retail investors obviously, and also an increasing share of our register by index funds. Uh-huh. And so they all look at the investment from a slightly different lens. We can't please them all. We hope that as we deliver results, they will be satisfied with however they want to capture in terms of unit price.
The portfolio is kind of, what's the phrase, global, isn't it? So it's both global and local. So do you find sort of contradictions in that, or do you find that there are lessons to be learned from the operations in here in Hong Kong that can be applied in China or even in Australia or London? Tell us a bit about how you kind of sort of manage the local and global aspects of the company.
In terms of culture, in terms of ambition, the vision that we've set out for ourselves to be a world-class real estate investor and manager means that we need to learn to be practicing all aspects of our business in a world-class manner. In that sense, it's I will look at that as a global element, that it's not the geography, it's more about the mindset. If we look at who are the best players around the world, how do they do it? And we demand ourselves to be at the same sort of playing field as they do. And so when you apply that standard to the real estate, and real estate have to be local, have to serve the people there, regardless of whether they are shoppers or office users, office tenants, you need to have the same mindset. We're trying to provide the highest standard. We're trying to communicate with them to make sure that we deliver what they want. We are very aware of the impact that we make to the community. So one of the things that we've coined last year as a mantra on running business is that business is no longer run as usual. What we have called business as mutual as a way of managing our business, how we engage with all our stakeholders and coming out with a shared vision. And so that is a global mindset for Link, but it has to be applied to individual asset, to the community that they are attached to. And I think that has allowed us to deliver pretty good relationship and hopefully good return to from the assets.
That does bring us into the sort of the community aspect of Link. Obviously, a lot of your assets here in Hong Kong are very closely rooted into their local communities. Tell us a bit about the Link Together initiative and the community aspect and its importance.
Thanks for asking this. This is something that's dear to us. As a trust, under trust law, we were not allowed to use trust money to actually do anything apart from benefiting our investors. And so what we did 10 years ago, is to change our trust deed so that each year we donate 0.25% of our net property income towards this Link Together initiative. So since establishing it in 2013, we have already committed 89 million Hong Kong dollars to support various charities and community engagement programs. And we were very mindful that this is not a, you know, make a lot of money and then put some money back to the community type initiative. It is something that we want to create, you know, some lasting social impact. It has to do with the community around our shopping centers, then supporting some elderly programs, supporting programs like the one that I mentioned for students, which is the Link University Scholarship. Yep. And so they are very much tied to impact to the community. We have also measured some of those social impact results as well, working pretty closely to the NGOs, with the NGOs around our communities.
Great, yes. It's good to have things that are of a very practical nature. Will those the programs that you have in place change as you become more international? I mean, so far, you've obviously got a collection of assets in China now. Will you do similar things there?
We have not decided to do so at this stage. I think our home is Hong Kong. We have learned from these past few years in supporting the communities that there are just so many people that need help. And so we can never satisfy all of them. So like a lot of things, focus is important. I think in the near term, I see that this program will continue to be focused in Hong Kong. Maybe in the future, when we are much bigger in different parts of China or other part of the world, then we will definitely extend the same thinking to it and see how we can help the community. But at the moment, it's very much focus on helping people in Hong Kong.
So we'll move on to talk a bit about the market now. The Hong Kong REIT Code recently had some amendments. What in these sort of stuck out to you as measures that will boost the REIT sector here in Hong Kong?
There are a lot of good changes that the recent REIT Code amendments will provide to the industry. For example, the ability to invest in minority stakes in the properties, or the higher percentage of for doing property development, relevant investments, changes, etc. At the same time, I guess slightly out of the terms of reference of the Security Futures Commission, Hong Kong government itself has been reluctant to look at the tax regime, which is the main impetus for REIT development in most countries around the world. And so, maybe that's something that eventually they'll come around looking at it and see what can be done. But, relaxation to some of these restrictions is important because, on one hand, we have to operate within these restrictions. On the other hand, we have no benefit from in terms of tax that other people enjoy in other countries. So, we think that the recent amendments does strike a better balance and a few more things that can be done. But, one just have to be patient with these changes.
Yes. Yeah, because obviously the REIT sector in Asia is getting more more competitive because there's more markets and more listings. So you mentioned tax. Any other ways where you think the Hong Kong REIT sector could be made more competitive?
I think the interest in listing in Hong Kong, just because it's a huge capital raising base. There are a lot of investors who understand real estate, whether they are listed as REIT or property investment company or developers. The ability for the banks, the brokers, the community of analysts who understand our business all helps. I think the one thing that I know the stock exchange has been working on is Stock Connect. And REITs are not eligible for Stock Connect with China yet, and that's something that hopefully will happen after China started to have their REITs listed, and hopefully then mutually it's something that can be set up for Stock Connect, and so that will expand our investment investor universe as well, that more investors, especially those from China, might want to invest in REITs listed in Hong Kong.
Okay, talking a bit about the retail market here, it's been tough for Hong Kong retail for a few years now for a variety of different reasons. And as you mentioned early on in the conversation, the e-commerce has been on the rise but had a sort of a jump in the past year or so. What would you say the outlook is for retail here, and what do asset owners like you need to do to get on, to thrive and also at least survive in the new environment?
I think in the short term, obviously, is the speed of vaccination. When would the border reopen to China and other countries, these travel bubble that's being discussed, and retail demand will then hopefully increase with those. Other aspect is firstly, obviously, economic cycle, unemployment rate need to come back down so that the sentiment, shopper sentiment improve. We need to continue to have tenants who are creative in attracting shoppers. So new formats, new ideas, new food cuisines and all that will help. And I think the government has been supportive, but at the same time, very cautious because of the public health issue right now. We can only hope that we will be back to normal sooner. I think it's not back to the past, back to some normality, but given the experience in the past year, for example, I mentioned the experience with online shopping, will make the future different from the one that we had in the past. And retailers need to just be a lot more smarter in terms of both online and offline.
Yeah. You also mentioned early on some of the aspects of your ESG strategy. And particularly, I was interested in the solar panels. Maybe if you could expand a little bit on the solar panels installations, about how I'm interested to learn about how effective you think they'll be. And also maybe talk a little bit about where Hong Kong in general could do better with regard to ESG matters.
We have tried to do this ourselves first, but also try to become a leader in this area. So we were the first in doing quite a few things. We have been reporting as, with the integrated report. We have participated in a lot of the best-in-class measurements and indexes from GRESB to FTSE for Good and Dow Jones Sustainability Index and all the different ratings. We have green building certification for now 50% of our assets and aiming to increase that number. So 2/3 of our assets are now green certified. We active in participating in designing some of these benchmarks as well, which hopefully pull the whole real estate sector towards a more sustainable one for the world. In terms of solar panel, there is a scheme that provides a financial incentive for us in Hong Kong that the electricity that we generate can be sold back to the utility companies in Hong Kong at a higher price than what we pay them for our usage. So we started the installation and the program will obviously take a few years with different assets that we own. But that will hopefully generate electricity that can save the grid from building up further capacity. And so across many aspects, and the green loans, this or sustainability loan and green bonds that we have done, green convertible bonds, it's now catching on as well. And more and more people, more companies and the government have been issuing green financing instruments. We hope that by having been the first in quite a few of these, we can share our experience and promote those ideas for people to really contribute towards long-term sustainability of our business.
Okay, great. Well, just to close out now, a couple of final questions about you, really. So you've obviously got a very busy working life and also got commitments to organizations like Apria that you're involved with. So when you get some, what do you do in your spare time?
Well, there are a few things I like to do that I don't get to do as much as I would like to. But as I said, I my son and I do cook. So I go to a fresh market shop and cook at home. I'm a golfer, trying to play as often as I can. Still very difficult to get that little ball into the hole, but trying to practice as much as I can. I do read very widely, different topics from leadership to just things that are totally irrelevant to what I do. But I do try to read as much as I can. And now with some time at home, then the occasional movies. And so there are enough things to do to use up my spare time. And so I just don't have a lot, as you said.
And this was going back to my LinkedIn stalking again now. Your sort of strap line is business leader, company director, dreamer, and father. So go to the last but one of those. What do you dream about?
A better world, a better family, and I learned at one of the sort of coaching sessions that I've organized for our management team, is that dreams sometimes are not the more practical. You need to come up with a plan and a vision. So, but if you don't dream, then I guess dream could be bigger and can be wild and all that. And so I like to have some spare time just, thinking about the less practical, bigger picture stuff, and then see how I can have some impact towards it. And I mentioned just now, just what we have been able to do in terms of carbon emission. 10 years ago, when we first started this journey, it was difficult because we now have, in terms of technology and equipment, much better prepared, much better equipped to achieve what was a dream. Now is a practical target, and that's why we set up net zero carbon emission by 2035.
And what's the sort of the next move? I mean, you've got plans for 2025 and then further plans for net zero, but kind of in the what's always your kind of idea for tomorrow for the company?
Well, I guess Link is a fantastic platform. We've managed to build a solid foundation for our investors. We believe that there are a lot of good things that we have done that will provide a strong foundation for it to continue to grow. How it will grow, I think, requires constant creativity as we deal with different requirements from our users, whether they are retailers or office tenants. And so very hard to imagine today exactly what the portfolio might look like in 10 years' time, but there are those few key elements that I mentioned, from net zero carbon to running it on a world-class standard. Those will definitely be part of that long-term vision. But the contents, exactly what is in the portfolio, will continue to evolve.
That's great. Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed. It's been great to talk to you, George. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you for tuning in to the Resurgence of REITs in Asia Pacific podcast series. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and we'll be back soon with more episodes featuring industry leaders and deal makers who specialize in REITs. If you like what you've heard and would like to give us feedback on future episodes, please do drop us a note on info@apria.asia. For more content and information, visit www.apria.asia or follow us on LinkedIn.